Something that's not the same sentence.
I feel my soul on fire.
Black.
Oh, this isn't right. My world if she's not there.
Hello.
And welcome to a podcast of one's own. Featuring us. Not really me. Featuring Sky.
Hello, yes.
And Kara.
Hi.
Singing Les Mis and Kate. Not singing Les Mis in the background. I think I said not the same line as before. Like a bad director would over your singing. And we're here this week to talk about Tom Hooper's 2012 film, Les Miserables. But before we get started unpacking that particular piece of majesty, we're going to start with the feminist question of the week, which this week is, as always, slightly related to the subject at hand, and if you can guess how, you'll get 10 points. Can feminists cry during movies?
I mean, they can and they do.
And I guess, like, the question here is more about overt displays of characteristics typically coded as feminine and weak.
Yeah.
Do you do damage to the feminist community if you cry audibly, visually,
if you
and
weep,
sob
openly?
Sob openly and more than everyone else in the room.
Probably. I mean, I hate to say probably, but, like, you just imagine being in a work setting and, like, the person that, like, goes and cries to the boss, like, physically with tears in their eyes, like, being a girl, and you'd be like, oh, women! And it does seem like a... Of course, that shouldn't be the case.
With the method of
normalizing
that...
But it is the
that,
case.
Of course it is. Would the way to improve on that be to, like, just have everyone be okay with crying? Because it also, to a point, comes down to personalities rather than genders, right?
Yeah, but, I mean, it would be that the, you know, personalities are equally spread out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are just as many men who want to cry to their bosses as there are women.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that women are maybe allowed to, or maybe that's the only way that they can get what they want. You know what I mean? Like, tears can be useful for women. And men, it isn't as useful, maybe.
I would also...
In specific settings.
I would also speculate that that might be true, and I would also just speculate that as another thing, like, I feel like women are really socialized to do very specific things with an emotional experience the minute they feel it, the second they feel it, actually. And so when that men are not really socialized to do, like, immediately suppress it and work really, really hard to not show any signs of the emotion, like, really hard. And I think that that's often not effective. It actually, like, a consequence of the things that women are often taught to do is actually, like, an inflating of their emotion or, like, a sort of, like, the emotion, like, pushing through what they're, the sort of, like, facade that they're supposed to put up. So I think that a lot of what, like, basically just through being in a position where your emotions are invalidated a lot of what, the things that women have learned to do and feel that they, like, and kind of have to do because of the way the environment has treated them, kind of sometimes is helpful and then at other times sort of serves to reinforce that stereotype and serves to reinforce the behavior that they're trying to not do, which is, like, cry or express the emotion.
I mean, from what I understand, a little bit of what you mean is, like, if I were really sad about something, I would maybe have to express my sadness even more than I thought was maybe applicable or maybe how much I felt,
mm-hmm.
Just because, to be validated, to be like, this is real, I'm actually feeling this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that at all what you were going at?
I think that's really true. I wasn't what I was saying, but I actually think that that's true. That's also a true thing. And I think, I guess what I was speaking about also is that sort of like women are really punished for showing emotion, either because it's reinforcing a stereotype or because they're called hysterical or crazy or whatever. So I think that a lot of us, some people, develop these tendencies to immediately suppress any emotional experience and, like, try, like, second you feel it, like, basically panic and try so hard not to experience or to show it.
Yes, some of us.
Which I find, in my experience, really exacerbates the emotion, which adds more emotion to the experience and makes it harder to not cry when you're putting so much work and so much, you know, effort into not being emotional, which mm-hmm. you can't control anyways.
Yeah.
Which adds more emotions like frustration. So I think that just some of the strategies that are really common among women that women have sort of been taught that they need to engage actually can sometimes make things worse in terms of like how much emotion you're actually feeling.
Yeah. And that isn't, I mean, of course, like, suppression of emotions is also a very stereotypically male thing, mm-hmm. But they are definitely expressed in different ways, as like the validation is different. So if a woman is expressing emotion, she might be really invalidated because of it, or it might be seen as like not real or not as heavy or not as important because, mm-hmm. you know, it's just women being emotional. Whereas men, you know, they suppress it and they suppress it and they suppress it, of course, stereotypically on both sides. Mm-hmm. But they suppress it and they suppress it and they suppress it. But if they show it, it's immediately valid.
Yeah.
Like a guy crying is like, that's real. And, you know, I'm sure in our lives, whenever we see guys crying, you're like, oh, fuck, I want to die.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like so much to handle.
Even just in media, that's the thing. Yeah, like, anything cried first before a girl crying is for sure a dude crying.
Yeah.
For exactly the reason you're describing. Mm.
And it makes you take that. And I think that what you were saying earlier, Kara, is really true, is that, like, if a guy cries, first of all, we're all, like, surprised. But then we get so serious, and our response becomes immediately proportional to what they're expressing.
If not more.
Like, if not more so. Yeah, we give those, like, they get so much support or so much response. But a woman has to do basically a lot more to get an equivalent response, which is why, like, it's women become reinforced, basically, for, like, having, you know, bigger expressions of emotion. But I also don't mean to, like, I don't think it's just that they express more than they feel. I think that there's times that people, like, actually feel more. Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably most of the times in our lives that the people around us feel more than they are expressing. Mm-hmm. But just to go back, like, a second, guys, when they cry, it's not like we're all immediately supportive. It should be clear that, like, they get strong reactions, but those reactions aren't always like, oh my god, this poor guy. They're sometimes like, look at that idiot. Like, they're always a little bit extra, and there is, like, the shame associated with it. But even if it's just, like, a little cry, they can have, like, lots of shame put onto it.
Oh, yeah,
and,
think
like,
about
lots of love. So, you know, just different.
Well, think about the idea of any guy who, like, cries too much. Like, the excessively sensitive male is not an attractive one either in terms of, like, median in terms of structures we put up.
Totally.
If I can pose the question, I guess, a little bit more broadly, then, what should be the contemporary feminist approach to, like, behaving in a way that is true to self, but, like, seems detrimentally stereotypical?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really, really good question and a really hard thing to answer, because, of course, I want to be like, you know, do what's in your heart. Like, you know, don't. If you feel something, please express it. But on the other hand, like, there are all of these politics that you have to be aware of, and, like, how everyone else is reading you. Like, I don't know, if I was in, like, a class and I was talking about feminism and I started crying, like, I don't know how appropriate that is, even if I was feeling it all at the same time.
Mm.
So I think it's really difficult, because, of course, I want to be like, feelings are amazing and have them at all times whenever you feel them. But I think that there is, like, a level of, like, I guess, appropriateness,
but I think,
as much as that sounds awful.
I think that that's potentially true, but I think it's important to distinguish then between, like, the feeling and the urge that comes along with the feeling. Like, crying does not
like
equal
the
sadness,
effect,
right?
And, like, the I see.
So, like, I guess what I mean is that, like, I agree that it's probably inappropriate to, like, emote in that way in a room, like, in a classroom or in a business meeting when you're speaking and you just start bawling your eyes out. That would be weird, but it's not necessarily inappropriate to, like, feel sadness.
That's a really, really good distinction.
Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, I think a couple things. I think that sometimes, now I'm really, like, aware of how much I'm saying those two words, but anyway.
I don't even know what two words you
I think.
I say so much. Now I will also be aware.
Yeah. Just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I understand that at all.
I think that sometimes the urge that comes along with the emotion, like the urge to cry, the urge to, like, you know, whatever, aggress, to, like, you know, run away or whatever, can come from things other than the emotion. Like, I think sometimes for me, it doesn't come from sadness. It comes from, like, the fact that I'm trying so hard to not feel sadness, and it's, you know, whatever. And, like, So I think just kind of teasing those two things apart is important, because obviously I would say that the emotion is always appropriate, is always valid, is always okay to feel. But the way it's expressed can sometimes be modulated according to, like, your context.
Well, I think that's a perfect answer to the question then. Like, can feminists cry? I mean, they can have all of the feelings of crying, but they might not, they might want to consider how they're expressing their feelings.
And if we bring it back to the, like, specific question of the week, I would propose that at media, probably an okay time to do it.
Oh, I mean, that's one of the very, like, socially acceptable places to do it, where even guys can, like, go to Les Mis and cry, like my dad. And
I just slapped my hand to my chest because of exactly what we talked about before.
Yeah, it's one of the only times guys are allowed to cry.
Also sports.
Are they allowed to cry at sports?
I think probably.
I guess if, like, their team lost and they had a little scare.
Or their team won.
Or their team won and they could cheer on that. Guys, are you listening? These are the only times. Your dad dies, you can cry.
Over-manning it. Not your mom.
But not your mom. Specifically not your mom, because you're all feminized and shit. Yeah. Only your granddad and your dad.
Yeah.
And your brother.
A cool uncle.
If the dog is male... One tear in the eye. If the dog is female,
no,
one
I think
none of them. None for that bitch.
I think weep for a dog. Weep for a dog. Stoic for a cat.
Yeah. Don't even give a shit about your cat.
Let's make a chart. I have a cat.
All right, that is actually funny. Let someone make a chart of, like, when guys can cry. That's good. Whatever. They can cry at Les Mis. It was really sad. I cried.
Yeah, let's also make a list of movies.
They're sports movies. That's the answer.
I throw it out there. Air Bud.
No.
This guy, no.
The dog plays basketball. It is a sports movie.
I know.
Movie.
There's a lot of components there, but it's also Air Bud, so it kind of disqualifies. I think if you have too many components, dog and
war
sports.
War movies are obviously, like, perfect for guys crying slash me.
That said, though, those movies that, like, because I often Google, like, movies that make boys cry, because it's a funny list, and it's always, like, Field of Dreams, Mr. Holland's Opus, that one with that guy who plays baseball and got that disease.
Rudy?
That's his
with
name.
Thing?
No, Rudy was football, but Rudy also. No, oh my god, Lou Gehrig's disease. The name of the movie.
Lou Gehrig.
It's not called Lou Gehrig.
Anyway.
Lou Gehrig's big journey.
Should we move on instead of talking about, like, what movies make men cry? Because we're just theorizing. We don't really know.
I've seen my dad cry. Feel the dreams every time.
Well, my dad just cried to Les Mis.
This is true.
I think he cried near the ending, but my mom said a little bit throughout. I wasn't watching him. I was also busy, like, covering my face of, like, how much I was crying near the beginning of the film.
Part of what I liked about this film is that, like, I mean, as everyone has talked about endlessly, like, the idea of seeing all these faces so close up and experiencing these emotions was very affecting for me.
It felt like a lot of, like, that, movie The Passion of Joan of Arc in that way. Like, it was tight on the faces, and it was almost uncomfortable at times, but really nice.
That's a very good comparison
film
there.
Studies 1000!
I definitely have not seen that movie.
That's the movie from that book I like. And also, it's, like, anti-theatrical, which is interesting. I wonder if your emotional reaction would have been the same seeing it on stage. Because I know for me, it wouldn't have been. It's
wasn't. I mean, I had seen Les Mis a few years ago when I was in high school, and I hated it. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought all of the music sounded so similar to each other, and it does. I mean, the music...
Because they have motifs.
Yeah, they have motifs, but which is nice when you really listen to it, but when you're not really listening to it, it's like 3 hours of the same shit. Yeah.
Except for Sing the Song of Angry Men, the best song in the whole thing.
I don't think it is,
song.
You know...
All the war songs.
It doesn't matter.
I come from a family of, like, obsessed Les Mis people.
So we have a little expert here.
Well, I just wanted to say that,
Les Misers.
Like,
Mis-heads.
Yeah, it's like they...
Ms. Tets.
My mother, like, has the sickness of Les Mis and has seen it, like, an obscene amount of times.
Misality.
Sure.
Go on.
Good. Misery.
No, you're contributing in this way.
I'm a pun in the background.
I think that I didn't, I like, love, obviously, I think it's, like, a wonderful, like, experience on stage, and the music is, like, really beautiful, but I don't have, I mean, I love it, and I'm, like, when I'm there, and I think it's better than the movie in a lot of ways, and when I'm there, I'm like, this is awesome, but I don't have that emotional reaction. I think those close-ups were a big part of it.
I think that they're a really interesting choice, because I think with a huge, like, epic, like, Les Mis, they could have done it two ways. Like, they could have done it the, like, pretty standard way of, like, creating the space, like, really realistically and really cool stylized way. Mm. So you have these huge wide shots of, like, revolutionary France and, like, all of these amazing scenic things. But instead, they did it super close and had pretty shitty sets, which worked because it was kind of theater, but it was, like, very distinctly, but you only saw them every once in a while. So I think that was an interesting choice.
There were some pretty amazing effective. Wide shots. Though.
There was some pretty stupid, like, that really one time they zoomed out. And yeah. It was the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
And that happened, like, I think it quite a few times.
There was
and,
one
like,
that
even
was
when
stupid.
It was, like, just the blockade, and you're like, okay. Yeah. Like, great. You know, those kind of epic wide shots are nothing compared to, like, other movies' epic wide shots.
Yeah, for sure.
No, for sure.
So it was an interesting, like, an effective approach. But do I think... it was too many close-ups? Yeah, I do. I mean, after Anne Hathaway's, which was so brilliant when she was singing I Dreamed a Dream, you know, you're like, oh my god, this close-up, it's amazing, and they're just going to do it the whole time? That's unreal. Like, it blew my mind. Yeah. And then it goes to, like, Cosette doing the same thing, and you're like, oh. Like, poor Cosette. And then Marius says it, too. And you're like, your face is beautiful, but, like...
I knew you would like Marius'
face. Oh, it's so clear that I would. First of all, he has orange hair and, like, freckles. Like, I love him.
And, like, bones. Just really prominent bones. Yeah.
Not to get, like, too review-y, but I think that those close-ups are obviously heavily contingent upon, like, the quality of the acting that's happening. And, well, obviously we all watch Anne Hathaway, and we're like, this is going to be so beautiful forever. And
do you remember when you saw the trailer and said she looked like she was bad in it?
I said that, too. She sounded like she was bad.
Yeah, do you remember when you said that? And I said she looked good in the trailer.
Yeah.
So.
You're right. You were right.
Yeah, thanks.
Well done.
I think that, I kind of understand what you're saying. I found the close-ups sometimes disorienting, and they were also tough for me in terms of stakes, because when you have everything on Anne Hathaway during what is, like, I would say the most high-stakes song of the film, or, like, at least involves the most, like, horror happening, and then you have, like, an equivalent shot levied on Eponine in her stupid song, it kind of creates this unbalance.
In Eponine or in Cosette?
Eponine.
Oh, really?
I hated Eponine. She's boring. I hated Cosette, too, but Cosette didn't have as much singing face.
Yeah, we'll get into
but, like,
more
I mean,
of why we hated those female characters and didn't.
The idea of sort of giving equal weight in frame size to these moments, like the moments that were so high of stake and so, like, really low stake.
You know, I do think that the stakes of the film were super off. Like, you think that the highest stake moment would be, like, trying to keep Marius alive, like, when Jean Valjean is trying to keep Marius alive. But that was, like, one of the most boring parts in the movie.
Also, how, like, did he not die of sepsis?
Yeah, I mean, like, during the war parts when he was, like, singing that song, I'm pretty sure it's called Let's Keep Marius Alive.
I'm thinking it. Vive Marius.
You know, that's...
Vive la Marius.
should be so important, but it really didn't come across.
That sequence wasn't as close as others.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I'm just talking about the stakes in general.
Yeah.
But I guess my first question is, like, I'm going to ask Guy, because maybe you know the history of Les Mis. but, like,
I just made
it
face.
Feels like such a random story to be like, hey, let's make this into a musical. Let's make this, like, three-generation thing or into a musical. What's up with that, Sky? What's up with the French people and being like, look at this epic. This sounds like the fun musical.
Let me put it this way, Kara, Kate. I agree. But you know what also feels like random choices around musicals?
Cats.
Let's make a musical about cats.
I don't know.
Phantom.
Cats Phantom is actually, yeah, Phantom is, yeah,
Phantom
makes sense.
Music, yeah.
Yeah. So,
cats, I mean, cats. Pretty weird.
I mean, Cats.
Kara,
but
that's,
like,
one of the biggest musicals.
Yeah, but an epic novel about the French Revolution and across, like long periods of time. Mm. It's like, you never see that.
No, you don't. But at the same time, like,
I mean, I'm happy they did it. I'm surprised.
I'm wondering.
I mean, you don't really see that, but, like, at the same time, like, you also just, you don't see anything like, not to be like too like, Les Mis is the best, but you don't see things like Les Mis in
probably
theater.
Don't see things like Cats.
You do. Andrew Lloyd Webber has written a lot, and none of it's, like, particularly stellar. So you see a lot of stuff like that, most musicals, but, like, Les Mis is not, like, really, like, anything else. And that's why there's, like, contention, like, is it an opera? Is it a musical? What is it? This is also one of the only, like, musical opera, whatever. Like,
just wall-to-wall singing.
This is the only one of the musicals that I would say, and this is coming from someone who like likes musicals a lot, or one of the few ones where like the music is actually of a very high caliber, like way beyond what musicals are normally like.
Yeah.
So like everything about Les Mis is kind of an anomaly. So I can't really explain why they would do it, but I'm glad they did.
Okay, sorry.
I kind of like I think that we should maybe should like add in the show notes or something. I don't know the era. Like, the when the original book came out, like, the French
like
book.
Like, 1860s or 1880s?
In terms... No, like, the music book, like, when the musical was written.
1980, I think, is when it premiered.
Like, I don't know what the politics were in France at that time, but I'm wondering if they're speaking to, like, there's something about, like, the tale of revolutionary France that was speaking to, like, the French public at that time that I just am so far away from understanding.
Like, I guess we'll find out maybe one day if we research it.
like, I think there probably is a link there.
Well, there is definitely a link there. Not even if they're just, like, feeling revolutionary, there's a link no matter what because it was made in that time period. And so it could be, like, not that they were feeling revolutionary, maybe that is the case, but it could be, oh my god, this is so hypothetical. But it could be, like, some sort of like nostalgia and wanting to wrap things up and make things into a love story and just, you know, have revolution not seem as important as maybe something else.
I mean, I think like it's possible.
Yeah, we have no idea.
Depending on where in the 80s it came out in, like when it was popularized to the English speaking world, there was like obviously politics of like greed and such that were going on in the 80s that I think this works against. And I think this movie is coming out in an opportune time because there's a lot of Occupy politics that are present in it, obviously. Because this movie is like the opposite of The Dark Knight Rises and is actually on the side of the Occupy movement, in this case, the French revolutionaries. But I don't...
To continue talking about politics without gender for a moment, is like it seems. It struck me as very weird because I was like, is this, I'm unsure if it's supposed to be a happy ending, if it's supposed to be like the love conquers all, if it's supposed to be like, you know, these people gave up so much for this one love and like he goes back to being a rich person. Mm-hmm. Like, is it the triumph of the bourgeois?
And also,
or is it a triumph of love or is it a triumph of like the underclass? I was so confused.
I don't
of,
think
like,
it's
what
any
it's supposed
of those
to be.
Things, but I think that, sorry, Kate, I interrupted you. Did you want to say that? I don't think it's any of those things per se, but I think if they were going to promote one, I mean, they might promote the love conquers all message because they do sing that. Like, one of their last lyrics is like, to love another person is to see the face of God.
So that's it's
like,
cried.
Yeah,
that
I mean, that was beautiful, like, but that's not like what did love conquer?
But at the same time, like, so that's what I wanted to say. So I guess at the same time, I think it's more than anything, I think that it's about, like, following the journey of one man through, like a bunch of shit, basically. Through a bunch of, like, misery to, like, paint, like, a rich context of, like, what life was like for those people. And that, like, I don't think that they, in terms of at least the politics and the revolution, I don't think that they wanted to, like, purport that there was a meaning or a purpose to the deaths of all those people. Like, there's that, the song by Marius, like, Empty Chairs, where he basically talks about how meaningless all of their deaths were, and there was, like, no reason they all died.
Yeah, but not only is it meaningless that they all died, he chose to go back with his rich father and live a bourgeois lifestyle.
There's...
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah, at the end, he has a very rich wedding. There's, like,
yeah,
there's all rich the wedding. Talk of the veil.
And so it's, like, I can understand, like, the meaningless of them all dying. And you're, like, that's really sad because, you know, they're being oppressed. And, like, no matter what they do, they're still dying for a cause that ultimately is going to win, I guess, the French... Spoilers for the French Revolution. But, you know, he goes back. And, you know, what did they all die for? Because, you know, I'm back where I started. And I'm happy living life all bourgeois.
Because Marius sucks.
I
love Marius, whatever.
You just like his handsome
face.
Yeah, I
do.
I didn't, like, love him.
To take a step back from that, though, I agree, Skye, that whatever meaning we have to derive from this film probably should come from the protagonist, and tying in again to, like, the idea to love another person is to see the face of God, and this is, like, a spiritual sort of theological quest, or at least...
For sure.
...has a theological catalyst, and then... The major plot developments in this movie all hinge on single moments of kindness, on love, if you will, that Jean Valjean has towards a single other person. And that's all of the progress in this movie comes from that. Yeah. And so I think that this movie, when it comes down to it, is probably more about individual action.
For sure.
Though I also think what's, even though the war songs are the best songs, though I also think that, like, my biggest problem with trying to analyze it was that the last shot, when it seems like France is going to be okay, everyone on those barricades is the dead people.
Yeah.
Like, those people are not alive anymore. This is not an optimistic final shot. Yeah. This is, like, a fantasy of a dying man. And so maybe, yeah, like, maybe the movie is inadvertently...
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I see what you guys are saying, if it was... The main themes probably is, like, religion and love, or God and love. But then, obviously, dealing with, like, the French Revolution and all of these revolutionaries, it is talking about, like, something political as well. But beyond that, as what you were saying, it's, like, it is this one guy, and the acts of this one guy traveling throughout this history is... But, you know, he has this such a vantage point of being, like, doesn't have to be a revolutionary. He doesn't have to be this, but you're still so amazing. You know, you're such a good person, even mm-hmm. if you're not a revolutionary. Uh-huh. So it does kind of speak a little, like, anti-political as well.
Yeah,
you know, like, he somehow gets to be outside of the bourgeois, even though he is in it,
yeah.
just because of his past. But we all accept that he isn't really.
And he also...
But that he isn't also really underclass, like...
Like, he doesn't have to, yeah, like, he doesn't have to be a revolutionary except for to go get Marius. And so it's almost like, to be a really good person, like, stay the fuck out of any political leaning.
That doesn't,
yeah, for sure.
That actually seems like more,
it's a good critique.
It's like, not, yeah, it's, and he has to, like, put on guises in order to infiltrate, in order to keep himself safe. But he is ultimately, well, oh, what was his prisoner in 20461?
24601.
24601. 24601.
Resident Lamus.
It's not even my fault. Like, I grew up with it in the car. Before I could, like, know things, I knew the soundtrack. I have a question I would like to segue to, unless you had another point.
No, I'm good.
All right. So here's something I've been thinking about with respect to Fantine, who we all know is the best ever, because Anne Hathaway, wonderful.
And also just the best character written, which we'll go into details of the three main characters.
Totally.
So, female characters.
So I had a couple questions. You know, so here's my kind of thing. So on the one hand, I feel like, you know, is it... At first I was like, maybe it is problematic that Fantine doesn't really have so much agency. Like, things just happen to her, sort of seemingly without any really, like... Like she's a victim of everything, basically.
Oh, like, aggressively so.
Yeah, like, and things just happen to her kind of without her contribution so much. So she's, in a lot of ways, incredibly passive. But I don't really feel, like, for me anyway, I didn't ever feel offended by that, and I never feel like it's problematic, because for me that's, like, a representation of what her life, and, like, many women's lives are like, in that, like, that they are, like, pushed through these things because of things like patriarchy and because of things like class systems and poverty and a lot of, like, actual, like, unjust things. So is it a problem that she's represented as, like, pretty much passive when the fact is, like, there are, like, she's victimized, and that's not necessarily, like, so inaccurate. Like, should women always be seen as active, even if, like,
even
they
if
are out of control of things?
To say that you have agency doesn't mean that you have control over everything in your life. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's a super important distinction because, like, people are victimized and we're all victimized and we're all, you know, put in these specific gender categories. And every single person, including women throughout history in real life, even women in the 50s, women in, like, revolutionary France, had agency in their lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter how bad the constructs are, when we talk about agency... In specific to film, we're talking about how much agency are the filmmakers and the writers giving them. Like, are they a real person being able to make any choices? And I think that she was a real person that had influence and had made sense in her story. So, like, she did change things in that, like, she did go to prostitution and she did, like, sell her teeth, and she had a goal. Like, the most important thing, she had a goal was to send money to her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could easily have it be, like, even worse written in terms of female characters and not have her have a goal at all.
Yeah.
You know, she's just a pretty girl who everyone was jealous of and then got into prostitution because she had no other work. You know, that would be a very acceptable thing in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, she has a goal. She has something that she's fighting for. She has a want and drive for it.
So, by agency, you typically kind of mean motivation, right?
Yeah. Motivation and working towards it. Like sense. She's a person. Yeah.
Are you guys familiar with, like, the term, you are, I'm saying it so that we can elaborate it for the podcast, of a character being, quote, stuffed in the fridge?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay. So this is, it comes out of particularly around discourse, like, the term itself, the trope, is named after a comic book. I am forgetting which superhero it is, but basically one of his...
That was, like, Green Lantern?
I think it's Green Lantern, too, but I might be wrong. We might be wrong.
Yes, us together. Maybe collectively wrong.
Sing the song of angry girls. And it, in one of the storylines, like, the entire plot, like, the thing that launches his, basically, quest for vengeance and the, like, subsequent events of the story is his girlfriend is killed and she is stuffed in his fridge. And so the phrase, and then obviously he gets rampagey and, you know, super folk die, but basically the phrase, it might have been Alison Bechdel who came up with it, but it might not have been, comes to denote any time that, like, a female character's death is used as an impetus for plot development.
And you see it in, like, oh my god, I forget his name.
Malcolm Reynolds.
No, let's just keep guessing until I remember, Tarantino? Guys. No. He made Inception.
Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan. All the time. I mean, go check out other blogs about it.
No, just check out ours. Just check out ours.
Yeah. Ours citing other things.
Yeah. But, so, I kind of want to put out there, like, do you think that Anne Hathaway is fridge stuffing, or is she not?
I think it specifically isn't, because, like, the what sets him into action isn't, like, so much...
Her death.
Like, the thing is, it's these two weird things. So, he finds God, and, like, that was a big change of his character. And so, like, that was probably more important to his character progression than Anne Hathaway dying.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like... if he did not find God, he wouldn't have reacted that same way. So that may be, it may be like a certain story progression, totally. But there was an inciting incident of like him being dismissive of like this issue that was happening in his workplace. And so that was a bigger problem than her death. Because she could have continued working and not had any, and not died and like not had any control over Cosette, and she would probably be happy if Cosette was happy being taken care of by this dude. I got lost in my point.
No, I think, but I think what you're saying is that, and I actually agree, is that, like, he didn't do these things because she died. He did these things because he felt bad about turning his back on her.
Yeah.
And her ending up in the situation that she ended up in.
Yeah.
So if she, for example, if she wasn't sick when they met and still said all the same things, he would have probably, like, given her a job back and then went and took care of Cosette and she would still be alive.
Yeah.
So then in that case, why did she need to die, narratively speaking?
Well, why does anyone need to die?
Well, what function did her death really serve in the narrative if he was going to do those things anyway, other than, like, making us feel so bad that this poor woman who, like, fell to disgrace then died?
Why does there need to be a way? I mean, I'm joking about why does anyone need to die, but, like, why does there need to be a reason that she dies? She's sick and, like, her life sucks.
It's true. I mean,
but do you think, it seems a little
like,
bit...
I think that there's, like, often, like, meaningless deaths of women in film, and sometimes, like, you know, just killing women for no real reason.
So if I were to make up one, we could make up a million reasons of, like, why we think the authors die, or thought that she had to die, or why the filmmakers, and why the music writers, and why we. But if I were to think of one from a feminist way, I would be, like, just to show the level of how terrible she was treated. And how terrible, like... prostitutes and everyone was, all women were treated at that level, where it goes from, like, shockingly a seamstress who, like, could keep her hair so beautiful and pretty, and, like, her face really clean and her teeth nice, unlike everybody else in the seamstresses.
Like somebody was putting on, like, nice bronzer or something, like some sort of glow.
So, some nice primer, and then, like, suddenly become a prostitute, and that to me actually was, like, somewhat realistic seeming, just to show how drastic it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I were to make up a reason for me, that makes sense.
Well, whereas, like, for me, the reason that I would make up would be that, like, her being alive would complicate the stupid true love narrative of the second half. And the idea of, like, love triumphs all can't happen if your mom's kicking around. And you also need to just, be this, like, orphan without any sort of context.
And I think also just the idea that, like, Jean Valjean, like, took on Cosette and Cosette changed his life probably would complicate the extent to which she could have been involved in that change. But
And if she was alive, I mean, I'm kind of happy that she died, because if she was alive, you know that there would be a love story between her and Jean Valjean.
And that's exactly what I wanted to bring up, the idea of having the one love narrative be restricted to these characters that show up halfway through the, whatever, I hate love at first sight narratives, I don't care about them at all.
It is a very specific, like, time period thing that, of course, now we wouldn't ever take that as, like, a realistic thing, but I think back in the day, when it was written in the 1800s, so long ago, I think it was a little bit more common trope.
It wasn't
not that it wasn't more common in life, but it was a little more common in, like...
It wasn't in the book, though. It was just in the musical. Sure. Yeah. Like, in the book, it was not a love at first sight thing.
What was it?
It was a long, complicated, drawn-out thing.
Like what?
From the research I read.
Oh.
Like, I haven't read...
The book is really complicated and drawn-out, though. So I think but the book is definitely... to assume that the source text has, like, a lot more flesh to it.
Yeah. the source text also, like... The source text definitely isn't love at first sight, though. That's, like, the one thing I looked up. Because the narratives are stupid.
Yeah. Just in terms of the role, so we all agree that, like, Fantine's narrative is, like, pretty great, but I was just wondering, like, in terms of
let's
the role
let's get to the shitty
women,
ones.
Like, all the other women.
Name them.
Eponine, Cosette.
Eponine and Cosette in particular.
Yeah. Oh, and, like, Helena Bonham Carter, I guess.
But. Yeah, but she's mostly, I think she's funny.
She's relief. Got agency. Am I right? I mean, that she likes to steal.
Yeah, but whatever.
Let's move on.
Yeah, we don't have to talk about her.
She makes it through the movie. She lives. Yeah,
she does live.
So does Cosette.
Yeah.
Eponine, no.
Okay, so let's go to Eponine. And my biggest problem, I didn't hate her like you, Kate, hated her, but it's just like you're thrown into this love story, which definitely happens really fast, like love at first sight, and then you're introduced to Eponine, who has feelings about this guy, and she sings, like, a super passionate, amazing song, but you're like, I have known her and this whole relationship for, like, a minute. Yeah. Like, I'm so uninvested.
Which is
like,
why I
can't,
hate her.
Yeah, I can't pull out the tears. Like, you might feel that way, but, like, it's not written in a way in which that is fleshed out, and I have any feeling.
I think
for
they
it.
Actually screwed that up in the movie, because I felt that way as well, and I used to, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with Eponine. Like, I thought I was, like, born to be Eponine on stage. Like,
every girl so does.
But, like, I think that in on stage, actually, they somehow make you align with her a lot more.
Do you think you're just older? Do you think maybe you're older?
Yeah. And it's also kind of frustrating because you're like, Eponine, why don't you just tell him? Like, it's been a while, probably. Why don't you just be like, yo, I'm in love with you.
But also, like, you don't know Fantine for very long when you're like, wow, your life has sure fallen.
She's selling her teeth.
It sucks.
Right. And that instantly makes me cry. But because that's a very different story from, like, oh, this boy doesn't like me. It's very different in terms of, like, emotional pull.
It also felt like that was one of the few things in the movie. Like, I mean, the movie felt overlong in some places, but particularly for me, that didn't add any density or complication to anything else other than just this one character, who ultimately is pretty quickly discarded.
You know, that's actually a really interesting point. Like, Eponine could be taken out of the movie, and it would still...
It'd be the exact same movie.
Same movie, and, like, the love would be just as torn, and it more... Because the important tear away from them is, like, the class differences.
Yeah.
And, like...
But then,
so
like, you like, you would lose two great songs. Like, On My Own and Little Fall Rain. Like, those are good.
You know, On My Own can be sung by someone else or something.
On My Own can be lost.
I think On My Own can be given to Eponine and maybe flesh out, I mean, Cosette, and maybe flesh out her fucking character
a
little bit.
She's a soprano, Kara. You can't give her that song.
Maybe rewrite it a little bit.
But I agree with that. Like, the idea of having any sort of background to Cosette and giving her any reason to fall in love with this guy, like, because she's feeling loneliness, she's feeling restricted.
But
they
bring up the loneliness after she falls in love
exactly,
with him.
Exactly, but
it's
having
like,
that...
You know,
you know what's weird about Cosette? Like, just as a side note that I only realized in the movie, is that, like, she literally lives in, like, hardcore isolation. All day, every day.
So wouldn't the song
this is, like,
On
the
My
first
Own
guy that she, like,
suit?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I suggested it. Because it would make so much
Yeah, this is the first
sense.
Teenage boy she's ever seen.
She's, like,
and so it does make
vacuum.
Sense of why she would fall in love with him. So, you know, I guess Cosette, I have a little more feelings
also,
for you now.
Also, can I just say, like, one other thing about Cosette that I never noticed until the movie, but I really felt
puff
weird.
Sleeves?
No, I noticed that.
She had puff sleeves?
Stage,
I didn't notice.
So
I didn't notice
weird. She had puff sleeves in every fucking thing, and they drove me crazy because they did not look good with her face.
Totally didn't notice. Totally didn't notice the sleeves.
That's not what I was referring to, but you're right.
Sky, don't lie.
That's a phenomenon.
He's coming up with a new thing now.
I felt really weird about her relationship with Jean Valjean from her perspective. Like, when I was watching the movie, and she's like, I can't remember, she like sings it, but she says something like, I have so many questions about you.
Please
and,
sing
like,
it.
Who you are.
I think that we should have a new rule for that. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, sure. But if you're going to quote it, sing it.
I don't know. Even if you're paraphrasing, I have so many questions about you.
Yeah,
this is some strange man who's like, come with me.
Yeah.
That one time you were scared, you're not scared anymore. Here's a doll. Now you're my concubine.
Now you're really rich. Now you can't leave these gates ever until I say you're not allowed to, like, meet anybody and you know nothing about me or why your life is this way.
I mean, yeah, it's problematic, but on the other hand, she was, like, being abused. So.
I'm not saying that, like,
I can understand why
that
character
her subjectivity is weird, and it's weird that she's not super weirded out by him, and that every time she asks a question, she's like, I'm so sorry, you're so kind, you're so good, but,
Stockholm
like...
Stockholm Syndrome.
It is called Stockholm Syndrome.
And hence another reason that she would just fall in love with some random, beautiful, red-haired, freckled guy.
Yeah, Jean Valjean, you're not that good.
Jean Valjean's
you know, but Jean Valjean feels bad about, like, totally... I mean, I'm sure it's hypothetical again, but, like, her life is probably better than when she was living
with she can afford those puffy sleeves.
Yeah, she got some puff sleeves on. Mm-hmm. And she has money to give to poor people on the streets.
Yeah, they both do. They go together.
Yeah, to give their money to the poor. Anyway,
I wanna go,
her song sucked.
Obviously.
I didn't really have anything to say.
Which one was her song? I don't remember it.
Sucked. I don't remember.
She just does duets. She doesn't really do her own thing, I don't think.
Amazing metaphor about Cossack. I want to loop back to Eponine for 1 second and just pose the question. Sky, perhaps as resident Les Mis expert, you know this. Why was she in drag? Like, that was not at all
so she could,
relevant.
Like,
so she could
be in the army.
In the army.
But,
she
like,
dresses
they,
as a guy
but
to
they
follow
all
Marius.
Know her. They all know her.
And there's, like, 10 of them there.
And there's, and they've all hung out with her before.
It's not
exploded. They're like, hello, new friend.
Yeah, but I kind of liked it because it did seem like, you know, when she was putting on the cap and stuff, I'm like, you go, girl. And then she, like, you know, gives her life.
But, like, I am kind of sick of the woman who dresses up like man and goes to war.
I've seen it, like, never.
Mulan. But, like, in Mulan, it's amazing because at the end she beats him using her fans and uses her femininity. And Mulan's the best.
Well, that sounds terrible.
No, Mulan's amazing.
No, I mean, that sounds terrible for gender politics.
No, it's good. It's a good movie. You should
Do you guys think that there's anything to the idea that, like, probably not. I just thought I'd throw it out in case anything comes back. But, like, you know, at the beginning when, like, little Cosette and little Eponine are both kids together, and, like, Cosette is, like, super oppressed and broke, and then Eponine's, like, that rich kid who, like, laughs at her parents in the bar, and then they switch, and then Eponine becomes really poor.
Yeah, nothing comes of it.
I mean, the thing that comes about from it again is I feel like it's supposed to be telling me that, like, her life is good now. Like, happy ending. She, the one who was abused and, like, came from a hooker mom, is now... a rich person married to a rich guy.
Yeah, like, we aspire towards money, and we aspire towards money, and we aspire towards marriage, and that's
like,
what this narrative is
like,
telling us.
Why the punishing of Eponine? Like it's not just, like, it's not just about Cosette, it's also, like, look at what's become of Eponine relative to Cosette.
How did that narrative happen with Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen and Eponine?
Like, suddenly hating Eponine?
No, like, falling out of...
Like, grace.
Yeah, because they moved cities. They moved to Paris. Like, why did that happen?
It's never really explicitly said. I think, I don't know, maybe the book probably fleshes it out. I don't know. Read it.
Well, okay, next week we'll do the book.
I thought it was always in Paris, so.
No,
they're in, like, some village.
You remember when he came in, he's like, oh, I'm the mayor of this town. It was the funniest exposition in the world.
Yeah. That was the mayor of France. All of France has a mayor.
A France of one's own, it wished to be mayor.
I think it also, like, that switching of the two, like, positions just gestures towards, like, the arbitrariness of what happens to these characters in a lot of ways, and, like, how pretty much out of control of their lives they are.
Do you feel like, I feel like it's the opposite, like, I feel like it's a, literary retribution, like, those who have it bad when they're young are gonna have it good when they're old, just because that's what people want, and people who are spoiled and bratty when they're young are gonna have it bad when they're old, because, like, that's how life should be.
But that kind of folds back into, that. If that's true of the narrative, then that goes into, like, the idea of it being pro-French revolutionaries and pro-the underclass, if that is what, like...
Or it's neoliberal, or it's, like, if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
It feels pretty neoliberal.
Like, yeah. I mean,
Jean Valjean is super neoliberal in that he, like, has all his own things and he feels like he can exist outside of all of these.
Or is he, because, like, if he followed sort of what, like, the parameters that he was allowed by society, he wouldn't be able to rise up, which neoliberal, like, libertarians, neoliberal people would pretend is, like, also, not a possibility for humans.
He's not particularly self-serving or self-improving.
Well, I was just, yeah, that's true, too.
That he constantly keeps getting rich.
Yeah. But I
would, yeah, but I think that
he's still striving towards being rich and always successful.
But I don't think, I don't know. I would say that, like, I doubt that his character is striving towards richness. I think his character is probably striving towards, like, purity and oneness with God, and, like, that, hence the charity, hence all that. Like, I don't
know. Yeah, totally. And then also, like, owning the factory of women.
But I think that what I, like, yeah, like, I think it's actually more complicated than him just being neoliberal, because I think that at the beginning,
well, especially
like, the
when he was written, neoliberalism didn't exist.
Yeah, capturing that ideology, because I think at the beginning, the whole idea is that, like, if he follows the law, if he keeps to his parole, like, he doesn't get the opportunity to rise up, to mobilize,
no,
to become a better person.
No, but that's not what neoliberalism is about. Neoliberalism is like, you can exist outside of the law because you're your own person and no one can control you.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also, yeah, sorry. I guess what I
that
really...
That doesn't feel like Jean Valjean.
I'm really referring to capitalism. I'm actually just saying, like, the idea that, like, if you work hard enough, you will succeed and become better. Because, like, he is an actual example of the fact that that is not true. That, like, no matter how hard he works, if he was following what he was supposed to be doing, he wouldn't have been able to better himself.
Yeah.
Nor would, like, Fantine.
But he can still better himself in other ways, which I think is a very, I don't have to say neoliberal, but a very libertarian idea, especially if we're going to get all into the politics.
But can he? Because he was like a thief. He was like
stealing
silver.
Yeah, totally. I feel like it's like the libertarian.
He was stealing bread, wasn't he? Oh, the
silver. No, but like after
he did it all by himself. And outside of the law, outside of the government helping him.
Yeah, but he was placed in a position where he had no other options but to engage in behavior that's considered corrupt and bad.
He's
a product of, like, systemic issues. Like, the reason that he stole silver, like, it's clear that, you know, his essential self is super good. So then why was he a thief? Why was he doing these things? Because the government, because things around him left him absolutely no other choice. He had no control over his life, which is,
except
like, an
for
anti-libertarian
he absolutely
idea.
Did, because as soon as he finds God, he becomes, like, super rich. And so all that he needed to become in control of his life is to realize that God is in control of
his
life.
And to go outside of the law, and to go outside of society, and to detach himself from who he was.
Yeah.
He loses a lot of his fortune when they move from the town he's mayor in, though. Like, it seems to be implied that he's no longer as well off when him and Cosette
I mean, he's still upper class in that he can give money to the poor. Mm-hmm. And, like, give Cosette a good life, and have a carriage, and, like, you know, be clean, unlike all of the underclass. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying he's the richest person in all of Paris, but he is definitely in the upper class.
I don't think the idea of the pursuit of wealth just, like, makes sense as a narrative for him.
I also think...
But that's not all that it is.
No, but, like, that's an enormous part of it, or the idea of self-improvement, of, like, this neoliberal reading that you're putting on.
There's a lot of parts of neoliberalism.
I think that another thing that's really...
Pursuit of wealth is not actually a part of neoliberalism. Yeah.
But the idea of self-improvement and how that's marked by wealth seems to be what you were saying initially.
Yeah. But that's, again, not all that
I think... Just one more thing about that.
I interrupted you, like, twice. Sure. This is more of a joke aside. Have you, like, looked into neoliberalism more than on
the TV Tropes page? Which does not exist. No, but you've talked about it, like, 100 billion times. And, like, I was just talking specifically about the argument you were just making.
Yeah. But it's... Sorry, go ahead. I'll let you
I was just going to say that, like, I think... And this actually is a parallel to, like, Dark Knight a little bit. Anne Hathaway's character in that.
Oh, yeah. I completely forgot she was in that.
This is also, like, a big part of it as well is about the fact that no matter how good you are, how much you find God, how hard you work, how wonderful a person you are, and how great your moral fiber is, your past will follow you. Your past will haunt you, which is personified in Javert, right? So, like, the idea that, like, there is no second chance, there is no fresh start, no matter what you do, no matter how hard you work, you will be running from your former self, which is not at all a neoliberal idea. Like, which the fact that, like, you cannot rise up and grow outside of your old self.
Though that said,
it's like a very socialist point.
That said, then what is, like, the symbolic resonance of when Valjean talks Javert, his past, into that weirdo suicide with the amazing folly of, like, wood hitting wood?
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounded painful.
Yeah, it didn't sound pleasant. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's like, that's kind of, I would say where my analogy breaks down. But maybe then it is neoliberal because it's like I've finally grown and been able to separate myself from my past. But at the same time, there's a lot of plot points where he's like, I am still my past. I am this prisoner. I'm like this ID
number.
24601. Okay, come on.
Yeah, I mean, like anything, I think that there is a lot of neoliberal themes, or at least a lot of ways that we can do a neoliberalist reading of it. But there's also obviously tons of ways to do like a Marxist reading of it, as you talked about with like capitalism, and a British accent reading of why they have them. Am I right still?
Yes.
I'm gonna complain about that. And you know, getting back to feminism, there's also ways of doing a feminist reading of it.
Okay, so you were earlier, Sky, you sort of earlier approached the idea of like, how do we tell characters, like, when we're looking at characters that are sort of in a historical realm and they're acting as they would in period, which tends to be not as women do today, and Kara, you were saying that there's a way to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I think people forget that, for example, when people are talking about, like, housewives in the 50s, you're like, oh, they had, like, they were so restrained, and, like, you know, they were always in the home, and no women worked, but, like, you have to remember that women were working all the time, not only as, like, household work as work, but they were working in, like, shops, and so I think it's just, it's a very easy, like, feminist tendency to be, like, women were oppressed, they did nothing, but, like, women were super influential, and they were agents of change, they were people just like we were. They might have had different, like, social circumstances, but everybody is still a person. So, yeah, I that's more just of a complaint of an easy way of thinking about history when feminists do it.
I guess my question is more about how would you tell a story about a housewife, then, someone who was in these roles that are very gendered and very...
I
would tell the hours.
There's lots of ways to do it.
Okay, and how
And I think that Pantene is a pretty good example of one specifically in this era.
Okay, so recognizing that within the context of Les Mis, when you also have to obey a source text, how would we rework Cosette?
Well, that takes all on about issues of adaptation, like how much they're willing to go, how much they want to stay true to the source text. I would, you know... There are little ways of updating it and putting a little spin on it. I am not familiar with the source text or with the original play or a musical, really. So I'm not the person to talk about these specific ones.
But I guess I mean, like, when you say, like, little rebellions or these little things you could do, I just want examples.
Well, we could talk about this with our Twilight podcast, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, there can be any example from, like, the shot reverse shot. I mean, you can subvert that, and that can be a little thing. So instead of having, like, a beautiful Cosette, I don't even remember how the scene went, so I'm not saying it did happen this way, but instead of, like, Cosette walking down the street and close up on Marius's face, you could have, like, you could follow Cosette looking at Marius. You know what I mean? Like, there are little ways of subverting, and that's what I mean by a little bit.
Yeah, and I think, like, even, like, I think that that's a great point, but, and obviously we could spend, like, hours just talking about subversion politics as well, but, like, I think that other subversion can happen, as we discussed in Twilight podcast, subversion can happen at many levels of an adaptation, including, like, for example, how a director would direct the actors, how the actors would then act, or even just act the roles, like, even, like, you know, there's been lots of instances, I know A Clockwork Orange has been cited particularly, where, like, you know, a small facial expression that the actor makes at the end of the film completely calls into question sort of what's thought of as the main premises of the narrative. So, like, you know, even, like, a raising of an eyebrow when it wasn't really happening like that in the source text can completely undermine that character. Or editing in a weird way, the way, like, or, you know, putting in weird soundtrack music the way Twilight did.
So weird.
So, like, you know, just, like, I think that it's a good question, and I think that I guess I would just say that subversion can happen, like, literally everywhere. There's always an opportunity to subvert.
And it comes with what I was saying about, like, looking at history and just being like, oh, women didn't have agency at that time. It's like, you look at a source text that was written in the 1800s, and yes, women's rights were shitty, but instead of just being like, you know, it's okay that we're showing women in this way because that's how it was, but you're like, it wasn't, because for the women it wasn't that way. Like, Cosette looked at Marius. It wasn't just like Marius looking at Cosette. So no matter what, even if you're adapting something from a specific time period, they're still agents, no matter how shitty their outside life is.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say one more thing about what you said earlier, Kira, about how, like sort of feminists can annoyingly lean on that explanation of, like, that's how things were at the time, which I completely agree with. And
another, I almost feel like that's not what feminists do.
I was going to actually say that's also what anti-feminists do. I mean, I think both do it. I guess I'm just more surrounded by feminists than anti-feminists.
They do it all the time.
I was just going to point out sort of the irony that, like, even I actually agree with that, but I also think that this is just, like, that particular argument is ironically leaned on by both feminists and anti-feminists to fuck things up, because, like, all the time when I've, like, been in, like, well, back in the day when I was, like, in film studies classes and there was something really sexist from an older movie, and I would obviously be taking issue with it, and then somebody would be like, yeah, but that's the time.
Yeah.
That's the context in which it came from, and it's like, and as if that makes it immune to critique.
That's sort of where I was trying to frame this question from. Yeah. Not, like, a feminist, that feminists do this, but more that, like, it's an easy excuse to be sexist.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't saying that you thought feminists did. I was complaining specifically about, like, feminists should know better, am I right?
Totally. But I guess more, like, I was trying to ask the question in terms of, like, especially in a way that's sort of perceivable to the mainstream.
Yeah.
How do we approach this?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
I think, again, just...
I was, like, biting my nails, and then I was thinking about something else. No, ask it again. No, Sky can answer.
I'm interpreting your question as basically as, like, if we're going to do something kind of pro-feminist or subversive, potentially, in an adaptation, in a way that would be, you know, readable, basically codable to the mainstream audiences, and at the same time maintain fidelity and still have it look like it is, you know, for example, a Les Mis adaptation. How do we do that?
Yeah.
Again, like, I hate to keep coming back to just, like, the basic looking at answer, but it is, like, the most simple of, like, it's readable to everyone. Most people probably wouldn't even notice, like, the technical difference.
That's actually where I'm coming down on this, is the idea of it being something that, like, I think we would pick up on as film students, but I'm not sure...
But it wouldn't be negative. You know what I mean?
No, of course not.
I think that it might be a little jarring if you do notice it, but you won't really know why, because you're so used to being in, like, the male viewer gaze. And so if you're suddenly in the women's, you might not even notice it. It's hard to tell because it's so rare.
No, obviously I love it as an idea. Yeah. I'm just in, like... I feel like it would have to go beyond that. Like, it would have to be a reframing of Marius as a whole.
Yeah, if you wanted to make it super poignant, like if I were a Mr. Hooper and I wanted to make a feminist Les Mis, you would do a lot of different things to make it obvious. But if you just wanted to do, like, you know, women, like, are also agents, like, I'm not making a specifically, like, only feminist Les Mis, you know, you would do little things to make them acceptable characters.
I think, just the idea of making Cosette more of a pursuer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or even, like...
It'd be easy and subtle, and it wouldn't change
The story in any sort of way.
Yeah. It wouldn't be, like, cutting out Eponine, which is what I would actually
get. I mean, I think we'd all cut out Eponine.
I wouldn't. I want to hear the songs.
No, but we'd give on my own to Cosette.
What's Eponine's alto? Okay. So she's an alto soprano. I'm sure those exist. Look, the thing about singing voices is they exist on a spectrum.
But can't you change it from an alto to a soprano?
Yeah, but it's meant for somebody who does, like, that belting thing that altos do. You know what I mean? It's not meant for, like, somebody doing an operatic kind of soprano. It just wouldn't be the same.
Whatever, Sky.
Whatever, so Sky's not a feminist anymore.
Make Eponine an alto. She only has duets anyway, so who cares if she's a soprano?
True. Isn't it interesting, just as a side note in terms of gendering music, the most feminist, she's an alto, the most feminist of, like, or sorry, the most feminine of characters, which is definitely, like, Cosette, and, like, kind of useless, has to be, like, that high soprano.
Yeah. And also that she's the only one that is happy in the end, and not dead.
Yeah.
I mean, Marius is probably
happy. Yeah, we could have interrogated that, but we're out of time. Too bad we didn't pick up on that 20 minutes ago, am I right?
I wouldn't much it.
We got to it, though.
Good job, team. So, I don't know if there's any music theorists out there who want to weigh in on that bombshell that Sky just dropped. Or if you have an idea how to rewrite or maybe modernize Les Mis and make it actually have an interesting second act, Marking thoughts about anything else. We didn't talk about anyone being handsome except for Handsome Face.
And Juras is handsome, or whatever his name is. War Guy.
Yeah, War Guy was super handsome.
I did not think so. I hated his face.
I actually thought that War Guy like and Marius should have switched, actually.
No, I totally agree.
No,
I totally agree.
Guys, I hated that guy's face, and you guys are so wrong. He looked like that comedian that had, like, the same mouth. I don't remember the comedian, but look forward to a picture but this comedian who has the same mouth.
If you agree with Sky and I, because you're correct, that Marius and his
Marius
weak...
Marius is so beautiful.
If you think that Marius has dead eyes,
yes.
Dead eyes.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go out there and say he's the strongest actor.
His empty chairs was pretty good though. He cried well.
Yeah, I was into his crying face.
Other guy probably would have cried better.
His face is so weird, so wrong.
A website of onezone.com. And weigh in, and until next time.
Are we gonna sing this out?
Sky's gonna sing
this out. Okay, which one do you wanna sing?
One of the women ones.
Okay. On my own.
Of one's own. Of one's own.
He's beside me. You're an alto. You were dreaming of this part. To sing it on your own.
Of one's own.
I don't know.
Can we rewrite this?
On my own. Pretending he's beside me.